Bet the board.
What do you mean you don't bet?
I mean, I don't bet. You know, I don't care. I don't. I never have, and I never will.
Yeah, right.
I'll bet you $20 I can get you gambling before the end of the day.
You owe me $15,000, pal.
Pay him. Pay that man his money.
It's the Bet the Board podcast.
God likes me. He really, really likes me.
In the end, I wound up right back where I started. I could still pick winners, and I could still make money for all kinds of people back home. And why mess up a good thing?
Here's Payne Insider and Todd Furman.
Welcome into the Bet the Board podcast. Sweet 16 on the docket. The field gets reduced from 68 teams in the opening round down to the best 16 teams in the land before crowning a national champion a week from Monday. Plenty of major announcements, but we'll get to those in a second. I am Todd Furman, as always, joined by Payne Insider. And Payne, some good moments of basketball that was pretty entertaining, and what I felt was somewhat marred by piss-poor officiating through the opening weekend.
You said the best 16 teams in the land are here.
Well, I mean, I guess that's the way we have to look at it. I know it's a one-game sample size, so no, they're probably not the true best 16 teams, but for argument's sake, just go with me here.
Okay. Yeah, should be a good weekend. For me, I don't really, you know, the officiating is what it is. There needs to be some type of system implemented. I'm not discriminating on age. There has to be some type of fitness test passed. It just seems like over the course of time, all we're doing to rectify some of these issues as the athletes get bigger, stronger, faster is just sticking another ref out there. And so for me, my biggest gripe, you'll see guys make calls that they're not in position to make, or they'll make calls for somebody else that is in position when you have too many, guys blowing the whistles. I was going to use a different term, but I decided not to. Too many guys blowing the whistle. You'll see guys literally making a call on the left baseline, and he's, you know, at midcourt on the right side. So those are the kind of things that I have issues with.
As always, the Bet the Board podcast brought to you by Bet Online, and plenty of, as we said, major announcements. Not only the Sweet 16 podcast today, we'll have a Final Four edition next week. And Payne, it almost leads into your favorite season of all, Major League Baseball, where we're trying to figure out exactly what date we'll drop the Major League Baseball preview podcast as well.
What type of prep am I going to need for that? Can I just plug in Mr. Baseball, maybe
a little Field of
Major
Dreams,
League 1 and 2, and
that'll mix it all up?
Yeah, I think that should probably get me equipped for the MLB preview.
I mean, I think our listeners are going to need a little bit more than that, so we have the utmost faith that you'll continue to preserve the Bet the Board brand and offer top-shelf analysis like you do each and every Monday and Thursday throughout football season, and much like we did last week, getting folks to the window to start the tournament with a winner on Princeton plus 7, watching that number close 5.5.
I'll see what I can do.
All right, I got a lot of faith for you there. But either way, we'll drop that note on our official podcast Twitter account, at BetTheBoardPod. If you're not following there already, encourage you to do so. You can find Payne on Twitter, at PayneInsider, and you can find me on Twitter as well, at Todd Furman. And while we weren't able to secure Doug Gottlieb for a second straight week, we do have a major college basketball personality to come in and break down the games for us to figure out who's going to be playing in Phoenix when the dust settles on Sunday. Excited to introduce our first guest. You can see his great work as part of CBS's comprehensive college basketball coverage throughout the year, especially during March Madness. You can also hear him daily on 92.9 FM in Memphis, 4 to 6 Central, and follow him on Twitter at Gary Parrish CBS. Gary, we had a crazy opening weekend, but for a man who follows college basketball as closely as you do, what was the most surprising thing you saw this weekend?
Well, I think from your perspective, you'd probably say, you know, from a point spread perspective, it's Xavier over Florida State, maybe. But I think in terms of, oh, wow, I can't believe that happened, it's got to be South Carolina over Duke, right? I mean, I know Duke wasn't a one seed, but they were the, I believe, at the start of this NCAA tournament, favorite to win the NCAA tournament, at least according to odds makers. They were the preseason number one team, winningest coach in the history of the sport, 9 McDonald's All-Americans. And, I didn't have them winning the national championship, but I surely didn't have them losing in the round of 32 to a South Carolina team that, frankly, hasn't been that good this year. I thought they were overseeded as a 7 seed. I mean, this is a team that, you know, heading into the NCAA tournament had lost 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 of its previous 9 games. 3-6 in the 9 games heading into the NCAA tournament, and then they pound Marquette and upset Duke. So to me, two things: South Carolina being in the Sweet 16 and Duke not being in the Sweet 16. I guess those things are obviously connected. That's been the surprising thing for me.
It's one of those things when you look at the way the brackets played out, and of course, hindsight is always going to be 20/20. But did Duke get a fair shake? And I can't believe I'm going to say this, having to play in a Greenville, South Carolina regional, given the reshuffling that went on, knowing that it was a de facto home game for South Carolina. And maybe they used the strength of that fervent home crowd in the second half to erase that deficit at the break.
Well, I was very careful with the way I wrote about this because I didn't want to do anything to completely take away from what South Carolina accomplished. I mean, they're in the Sweet 16 for the first time since the 70s. Frank Martin deserves all the credit he can get. So I use the word contributed. There is no denying that playing in South Carolina against South Carolina contributed to Duke's demise. And what's fascinating is that this is all rooted in politics. I'm sure you guys know, but for folks listening who don't, the former governor of North Carolina, Pat McCrory, passed or signed into law a bill called the HB2 bill. It's more commonly known as the bathroom bill. It's mostly considered a discriminatory bill. And the NCAA decided last year, just like the NBA decided last year, we're not going to do business in your state until you get that law off the books. We don't feel like it's we feel like it's discriminatory. We're going to use whatever influence we have to try to bring about change. And whether you agree or disagree is beside the point. The point is that the NCAA had scheduled these games. The ones we watched this weekend, they were supposed to be in Greensboro, North Carolina. They first announced they were going to move them because of HB2. They basically said, get HB2 off the books or we're moving this. North Carolina as a state didn't budge. They moved the event. They could have moved it anywhere. And I suggested, and I'm not pretending that the NCAA read my column and said, oh, that's a great idea. Let's do that. but they might have. I mean, like, I mean, and let me be clear. It wasn't an idea unique to me. Like, I can't imagine I'm the only person who had this thought. But I am the only person I know that wrote it. And I said, hey, if you really want to hammer home the message you're sending, you know, South Carolina was banned from hosting NCAA events for many years, in excess of a decade, because of the presence of the Confederate flag on state grounds. And when South Carolina, after the Charleston mass murder, decided to come into the 21st century and get rid of the Confederate flag, the NCAA then opened it up to South Carolina again, said, hey, okay, you're off our bad list. You can host championship events again. So the column I wrote was, hey, if you want to hammer this home perfectly, take those games from Greensboro and put them in Green, or I didn't actually say Greensville, South Carolina. I think I said Columbia, South Carolina. But the point was the same. Like, put them in the state of South Carolina because it does it works on a variety of levels. A, to the extent that people have already bought tickets for that pod, like, it ain't that, like, we're talking about bordering states. We're not talking about different parts of the country. So it's drivable. If you were wanting to or willing to drive to Greensboro, you can also drive to Greenville. But beyond that, the larger message was just perfect. Hey, North Carolina, once upon a time, we were treating South Carolina like you. Then they did the right thing. Now we're rewarding them. You do the right thing, and we'll reward you as well. And so the NCAA decided to go ahead and do it exactly that way. They took those games out of North Carolina, put them in South Carolina. And then just because of the way the bracket was put together, you looked up and suddenly Duke was in position to have to play South Carolina in the state of South Carolina. And again, I'm not trying to pretend that that is the only reason South Carolina won, but it is undeniable in my mind. And ask anybody who was in that building if it felt like a home court advantage. And you know better than I probably how big of a deal home court advantage is in college basketball. And so I think it's reasonable to suggest, accurate to suggest, the HB2 law cost the governor an election, because it did. He was voted out of office last November. And it also cost Duke an opportunity to go to the Sweet 16 because it forced them out of their state and into the team that they had to play, home state. And that all led to what we saw on Sunday night.
Yeah, always incredible how politics can impact some of this. And when you look at you know, what Nevada has had to deal with on a different level. We don't have a bathroom bill. We don't have a Confederate flag hanging anywhere around here. And we're still pushing to try and get a regional out here, hopefully in the next few years, having had discussions with some of the people at Las Vegas Events, that we've become the unofficial home for conference tournaments. When we talk about postseason basketball, getting an NCAA regional clearly would be a step in the right direction. And Payne, Gary mentioned Florida State being disappointing. I know it's a program you follow closely. What do we begin to make of this Seminole team and the egg they laid against Xavier as overwhelming favorites in the round of 32?
It was tough to watch. I mean, Chris Mack is fantastic. Literally just twisted Leonard Hamm's brain into a pretzel, and you just watched it unfold right in front of you. That's tough. Xavier had so many injuries down the stretch. Nobody thought they were really going to make a run. Everyone thought they were dead at that point. Two big wins in the conference tournament to really get them and seal their berth, and then two big wins in the tournament. For Leonard Hamilton, though, it's tough because, yes, only one Sweet 16 in 15 years, but you look at the whole entire landscape, third most wins in the ACC since 2005, behind only Duke and North Carolina. It's a football program, not sure where you go, but you look at the talent there, and certainly this feels like an underachieving effort.
Well, when you look at, to Xavier's credit, I guess we have to say that you're giving him a lot more, putting punctuation on wins over DePaul. I mean, as you said, this was a team, three wins basically in the month of February, or two wins over my beloved DePaul Blue Demons. So I wasn't going to say this team was headed in the right direction, but Chris Mack clearly getting the most out of his team when he needs the most. Now, I'll open the floor up to either of you guys, since we don't want to be all negative with about a glass half empty. What's the performance surprised you the most for a team taking their game to the next level and getting to the second weekend that we didn't really anticipate, maybe aside from Xavier in South Carolina?
Gary, I'll let you go first.
I was surprised by Florida. I'm surprised, A, that they're in the Sweet 16. I'm mostly surprised that they beat Virginia by, I guess it was 26 points, 65-39. I mean, I would be lying if I told you I saw any of that coming. Like, I didn't think Florida would beat Virginia. I didn't think if Florida would beat Virginia, they would beat them by 26. I didn't think anybody could beat Virginia by 26, given that Virginia is the best defensive team in America and plays at literally the slowest tempo in America. They ranked 351 out of 351 in Division I basketball in tempo. So fewer possessions. How do you beat them by 26 points? And this is a Florida team that was 1-3 in its last four games before the NCAA tournament. A Florida team that was in a fight with East Tennessee State for a half before it played Virginia. A Florida team that lost John Abegnu, who was a starter, to a season-ending injury. So they're shorthanded, not playing well, and now they're in the Sweet 16 after beating Virginia by 26 points. That's pretty remarkable.
Payne, what really jumped off the page for you?
I think it's Michigan. They went through the gauntlet in the Big Ten, weren't sure if they were going to have legs left. They certainly used the plane crash as momentum. And then they've had just outstanding second halves of basketball in both games. Not saying, they got lucky, but they were very fortunate. You hit 11 of 15 threes in the second half. And then Wegner goes absolutely nuts for a career high. It was very impressive to see what they did offensively there. They scored nearly 1.2 points per possession in the second half against a Louisville defense that's extremely stingy. So for me, based upon what they did in the Big Ten, weren't sure they were going to have the legs coming into this tournament. And they've kind of defied some odds. Sometimes you just get a team like this that's hot down the stretch playing for a greater cause, and the momentum keeps moving forward for Michigan.
Well, one last thing, guys, before we get into the individual games and some of the regional numbers for this weekend coming up. Gary, when you look at the way the ACC has performed, we knew they were supposed to be the top dogs coming into the postseason, only one team into the Sweet 16 in the form of North Carolina, who still remains overwhelming favorites to get out of their regional. We see three Big Ten teams get through in what was supposed to be a down year and a couple of questionable seedings there. The SEC, does it take away from your body of work during the regular season when we talk about the Sweet 16 entrance versus what we expected when the field was announced 2 weeks ago?
It undeniably takes away from it. The debate is how much. People have for years, and this isn't unique to the present day or any individual person, have for years drawn massive conclusions from in the NCAA tournament and what happens inside of it. It is how we crown our national champion. It's fun. It's fine. Whatever. But I don't think anybody could intelligently argue that it's the best way to crown a national champion if your goal is to make sure the best team is your national champion. Like a single elimination tournament of 40-minute basketball games, obviously not anything can happen, but a whole lot of stuff can happen. And so if you want to scream that the ACC was overrated now, it's a good time to do it. But I've always been hesitant to draw big conclusions off of single 40-minute games. But we do it all the time. So right now, the most common thing is the ACC was overrated. They had eight teams in, one loss in the first four, four lost to lower-seeded teams, only one advanced to the Sweet 16, and every bit of that is true. And so, yeah, I assume the ACC probably was overrated. But does it mean they were vastly overrated, they didn't deserve nine bids? I don't know. I'm uncomfortable with that because it really is just the byproduct of one game. Like, we played for 4 months, and then we let one game decide everything. In other words, I'd put it like this. I don't even know what Steph Curry did last night, but let's just say that Steph Curry shot the ball poorly last night. Like, let's say he was 3 of 12 from three-point range.
I think Steph last night actually had one of his better games.
Okay, okay.
But he did mix it up a little bit, and there were odds circulated through social that maybe Steph's going to have to get in the octagon at some point to create some intrigue.
I did see that. That was interesting. I didn't see the game, though. So for the sake of the conversation, play along. Let's say Steph – let's just talk about the next game.
Yeah.
Let's say he goes 3 of 12 from three-point range, right? And would you conclude from that Steph Curry is an overrated shooter? Of course not. He's probably the best shooter of all time. But in that one game, he was a poor three-point shooter. That is what we do with NCAA teams all the time. We disregard everything we know about them for 4 months, and we say – that team that we just watched in the NCAA tournament lose or win is terrible or great based on one game. It is just one game. It's the most important game. But in terms of labeling success or failure or overrated or underrated based off the results of games that are sometimes determined by seeds, matchups, and as we just talked about, location, I don't think that's a very smart way to do it. I don't think the SEC was underrated just because it now has three teams in the Sweet 16. And while I can acknowledge that the ACC teams probably weren't as good as maybe we made them out to be, I still think if you went back and tried to build a bracket and seed teams again on Selection Sunday, given only the data we had up until Selection Sunday, you'd probably come to the exact same conclusion.
I do have to give one group of individuals full praise. Anybody who had an under 15.5 ACC tournament wins ticket at BetOnline clearly cashed that handsomely. I think they envisioned much more of a sweat than what they had getting comfortably to the window after the opening weekend. And guys, as we look towards the games on Thursday, we can start in the West region at the S&P Center in San Jose, where the 1, 2, 4, and 11 seeds got through. Right now, to win the West, Gonzaga a +130 favorite at BetOnline, Arizona behind them at +140, West Virginia in the middle of the pack at 4-1, Xavier, of course, a long shot at 12-1. And Payne, we can start with you. Should we be buying into Gonzaga knowing where they've been power rated all season long and some of the things you've seen, the adjustments you guys have made with the Bulldogs?
Tough to ignore our power rating. Visually, they look different with the transfers. Better guard play, better wing play, more athletic. Certainly better defensively than recent versions of Gonzaga. But I think the metrics might be propped up a little bit playing in a non-Power 5, a conference that ended the season outside the top 10 overall. We have them the 138th toughest schedule. You looked at their 6-0 against the top 25, three of those against the Gales. They caught some teams early in the season that weren't at full strength, either physically or mentally. So in general, we should be buying, but I think there's probably a better question is Gonzaga elite? Can they prove the Sharp guys right, power ranking them the number one team in the country, and cut the Nets down? I'm not so sure of that.
The number right now for that game, Gonzaga, a 3-point favorite, total 148.5 at BetOnline. And Gary, when we look at the matchups on the court, will this West Virginia press be able to force Gonzaga into countless turnovers? We saw them struggle a bit, albeit with a relatively large lead in the second half against Northwestern, and pretty laissez-faire with the basketball in their opener against South Dakota State.
Listen, I think West Virginia is going to turn anybody over. Notre Dame was ranked number one in the country heading into that round of 32 matchup in offensive turnover percentage. In other words, for folks who don't follow those numbers closely, it just means that they turn the ball over at a lower rate than literally everybody else in the country. And they had 9 first half turnovers. They got a little more comfortable in the second half. I think only finished with 14 turnovers in the game. But if West Virginia is going to turn Notre Dame over, they're going to turn everybody over. Now, Gonzaga is also good at taking care of the ball, top 26 in the country. But you just have to know going in that you're going to give it to them every once in a while. You got to make up for it somewhere else. You can't, and people say this all the time about basketball, like you can't replicate that, you know, but like sometimes you can. This is actually an instance where you can't. You can watch it on film. You can prepare for it. You don't know what it's like until you get on that court, because Gonzaga will have not – And by extension, its players will have not ever in their entire lives dealt with anything like what they're going to see in this matchup. But still, it's not like they got bad guards. Like Nigel Williams-Goss is a former McDonald's All-American who is now, you know, probably 22 years old. He's played at the highest levels of the sport, won big games. I think he's going to be able to mostly handle, you know, what's going to be thrown at him. His turnover total will be higher than it probably has been all year, or at least it'll approach that number. But you just have to understand that's part of playing West Virginia. You're going to turn the ball over. But it doesn't mean you can't beat them. Even teams that turn the ball over against them have beaten them this year. I think Gonzaga is going to get out of this.
Payne, where do you think this number goes as we sit here Wednesday morning?
There has been sharp money on West Virginia early on. I do want to kind of just make mention of this, because we have the metrics in front of us that say the Zags don't really turn it over much, but they play in a conference that doesn't pressure defensively. They're not going to be that much better athletically. And there was an astute analogy from Gottlieb last week on this podcast. It's not about West Virginia's defense, but about their offense, because if the ball isn't going through the hoop, it's tough for West Virginia to be West Virginia. And so I'll say this. There's been, again, the sharp money on the Mountaineers, but there is an opposite side to that coin. And this isn't Bucknell, who's, you know, 115th in the country at defensive rebounding or 207th in turnovers. It's not Notre Dame, where you get them on a short turnaround to prep for something this sophisticated. They don't have an interior presence defensively. This is Gonzaga. They do have time to prepare, but they play a pack line defense. They're number one in the country. They allow 0.84 points per possession. They allow opponents to make 40% of their 2-point shots. They rebound well. So if West Virginia doesn't shoot it overly well, it's going to be tough to figure out how they get buckets and do what they do best. I love this team. I love Huggy. We have them power rated the third best team in the country. It's probably a little ridiculous, but when you get to this point, you have to be able to flip a switch and do what you do best. And unfortunately for West Virginia, something must occur first for them to do what they do best. And that's the one struggle I have backing West Virginia in this spot right now.
From the early game to the late game, where Sean Miller matches up with his old team for the second time in 3 years in the round of 16. You guys hit on it earlier. Xavier, a little bit surprising, the lone double-digit seed to punch their ticket to the second weekend. Arizona, a 7.5-point favorite at BetOnline. Total in this game, 145. And Gary, Payne and I have been relatively critical of Arizona, thinking they've played well above their skis. So maybe having a third voice here to either talk us down or corroborate our thought process goes a long way. But how do you see this matchup playing out?
Well, I know a lot of the metrics don't love them, don't rate them where the committee seated them or where most AP voters or even I had them much of this season. And I'm always aware of that. But I think they're terrific. I mean, I think they're one of, when this tournament started, I had 8 teams that I thought could reasonably hope to win the national championship. Those 8 teams were and they would differ from your guys. I suppose we're looking at this from different perspectives. And frankly, yours is probably more accurate than mine, because I am terrible at picking games or projecting anything. But I had Gonzaga, Villanova, North Carolina, Kentucky, Kansas, UCLA, Oregon, and Arizona. And I was less sure of Oregon because of the Chris Boucher injury, but whatever, I still left them in the conversation. I think Oregon is so now we're down to six because Duke and Villanova are out. And I think Arizona's I saw nothing in the first two rounds of the NCAA tournament that made me want to move off of that. I know they struggled to some extent with St. Mary's, but I think St. Mary's is really good. Like, I think St. Mary's is a legitimate top 20 team that just didn't match up well with Gonzaga. And so their reputation was much lower than it probably should have been. But I've got Gonzaga beating Arizona in the Elite Eight to go to the Final Four. But it wouldn't surprise me if Arizona ended up representing that regional down in Phoenix. And then you get, you know, at Final Four in Phoenix, Arizona, with Arizona, and just go ahead and win the whole thing. I don't think they're going to win a national championship, but I could see it, sure.
I'll say one thing. Those Arizona fans, they travel real well, and right in their backyard in Phoenix playing Glendale probably only helps their cause. It might create a bit of an obnoxious atmosphere, as we've seen out here in Vegas, and this coming from someone with close ties to University of Arizona, knowing my sister is alum and a diehard Wildcat fan. Payne, you've picked up on an interesting trend, though, with Arizona, looking to bet against them. It's not the full game angle that's been attractive. It's been looking to play maybe the first 20 minutes if you're going to try and make a case for Xavier here.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a surprise. They kind of sleepwalk to start games. That's kind of what we've seen. And in general, this is just a good game. I want to see the coaching here. Perception is Arizona's elite. I'm not sure. I think they've gotten more of the favorable draw, both opponent-wise, location-wise. So it makes sense for us to talk about them like they're elite from a bracket perspective. To me, just something's missing, whether it's aggressiveness or even player-wise. Trier's fantastic, but he has the off-court issue, so questionable decision-making. Markkanen, make no mistake, he's a for sure lottery pick. But I talk to many coaches, and there's one thing about foreign players. They pick the game up late, so the basketball IQ tends to not be up to par. Kadeem Allen, know him very well. He's the heart and soul, but he's a JUCO guy. So can they put it all together? And you alluded to this, the home court advantage. The Pac-12 tournament, if you've ever been out there, it's at minimum an 80-20 split every single Wildcats game. So I wanted to watch that tournament. And what I noticed against Oregon is you have a home court advantage. Boucher goes out a few hours before the big game. You get every single call known to mankind, whether it's a backcourt violation that turns to three or the late charge on Ennis that should be lining up at the free throw line to shoot a pair there. Dylan Brooks gets in foul trouble, and you still really don't look good. You squeak by. The one advantage here is Xavier's done well, fantastically, you know, coaching. Chris Mack's been great in that regard, but I think this is where it catches up to them, obviously, talent-wise. I'm not sure Mack can surprise Miller with anything at this point, you know, having spent time together at Xavier. That's my lone fear there. But I will say this. I think if you like Arizona, you probably go early. If you like Xavier, you wait. It's the late bailout game of the night. So I think that's probably the recipe from a betting standpoint. I do think eventually Xavier attracts sharp money.
An early indication, slight public lean, about 60% of the tickets at BetOnline coming in on Xavier in this game. Have to imagine things will balance out a little bit more as we get closer to tip-off, and you allude to, Payne, it being the final game, barring some overtime or unforeseen circumstance taking place on Thursday night. From the West to the Midwest, that'll be taking place at the Sprint Center in Kansas City, Missouri. You want to talk about home court advantage. There may not be a round of 16, a round of 8 game where one team will benefit more immensely than the Kansas Jayhawks, who are listed as the favorite to come out of the Midwest at 5-4. Michigan, a shade better than 3-1. Oregon checks in at 4-1. And Purdue, the so-called long shot, at +4.25. Gary, we'll start with you. We may as well look at the Michigan Wolverines. Is there anything that gave you an inkling? I know they won 10 out of 12, you know, late in the season, to give you the feeling that they were capable of putting together this type of performance, six games where they've looked absolutely tremendous on the offensive side.
I wouldn't have seen it coming 2 months ago, but given the way that they played down the stretch and obviously in the Big Ten tournament, I don't think you should be surprised that they're in the Sweet 16. I had them losing to Louisville, but that said more about what I thought of Louisville than Michigan. But I even wrote in advance of that game, like, it seems crazy to pick against Michigan at this point with the way they're playing. They weren't just a hot team. They They're coached by one of the very best teachers in college basketball. Like, you talk to college basketball coaches, nobody will do anything but speak well of John Beilein as a teacher and a tactician and just a coach in general. So he's you know, not all teams get better. Coaches love to say, just want to be playing our best basketball in March. You know, every coach in America says that. Well, every coach in America isn't actually good at doing that. But Beilein is one of the better ones. Izzo's another obvious example that people cite all the time. So take me back to January. No, I never saw this coming. I wasn't certain Michigan was going to be in the NCAA tournament. But take me back, you know, through the stretch. Yeah, you could see it building towards something special. And now I think they're going to the Elite Eight. And, you know, Kansas and Kansas City, that's a tough deal. But you could reasonably argue nobody in the country is playing better than Michigan right now. And so if they ended up in the Final Four, it certainly wouldn't be the craziest thing we've ever seen.
Offensively, the team has been absolutely incredible through their Big Ten championship run and, of course, the first two games in the tournament. Payne, we talk all the time about selling stock at the top of the market, and I think when you look at Michigan as a one-point favorite now with a game total of 146.5, where was this number if they would have played 2 weeks ago, if they would have played a month ago, or as Gary alluded to in the middle of January, we'd have been talking about Oregon not just as a bucket or two-bucket favorite, but pretty substantial chalk in this one.
Yeah, certainly with Butcher, if we rewind it that far. This is the problem for me in this game. As a sports bettor, we're taught to sell Michigan here, without question. From an X's and O's standpoint, I don't love the matchup for Oregon. Gary alluded to Coach Beilein in their offense humming right now. It's a top five team in offensive efficiency. We talked about what they did in the second half against Louisville. And if you just watch the game, every single possession, Beilein's able to get the defense to switch into a mismatch every single time down the court. It's shocking. And I think that's going to be a problem for Oregon here. This is the type of game stylistically where they're going to miss Butcher, a guy that can guard multiple positions. When your defense gets caught in switches and mismatches, you need that versatile guy. I made note of this last week, but it's important to bring up again. Certain games, Butcher's injury isn't a big deal, but for games like this, it's huge. Dylan Brooks has moved to the four. He is a damn problem offensively at the four. But defensively, we saw Arizona do it in the Pac-12 final, and we know Michigan is going to do it. And that's force a switch that puts Dylan Brooks on an island up top versus Walton or in the post against Wagner. And because Brooks has that killer mindset, he's going to think he can guard in either situation. So it scares me if he gets in foul trouble now that Butcher's gone. Brooks has got to play 38, 39, 40 minutes a game. He can't get in foul trouble and play 31, 32, 33 minutes for Oregon to have a chance here.
So total surprise you at all, Payne? Only 146.5, given the way both these teams have operated at the offensive end of late?
A little bit, but both coaches are genius. And with extra time to prepare, it will be interesting to see what they implement defensively. That would scare me a little bit here. But if things start going and it becomes a track meet, which it's very possible, I wouldn't want to go under that total. So for me, I'm out right now. I do lean Michigan just because of that style advantage. But I don't think I end up getting a ticket on them just because of the market perception and me just kind of not visually seeing this as a sports bettor. And you know my feelings. I feel like they've been a little fortunate the first couple games. So I am certainly, I don't think I can be on Michigan, but I do lean that way.
Gary, when we look at the late game between Purdue and Kansas, Kansas a 5-point favorite, total in the game 156.5. And I guess from a star power standpoint, there may be no better game in the round of 16 than seeing Caleb Swanigan, the double-double machine for Purdue, matched up against the likely favorite for National Player of the Year in Frank Mason. How do you see this on-court matchup playing out? And what do we make of Kansas's players' comments or Bill Self's comments that basically the team disregarded everything he had to say and they only went on to beat Michigan State by 20 points in the round of 32?
Yeah, I that's one of the few games I had pegged correctly. I thought Kansas would run away from Michigan State. You talk about selling high. I think after watching Michigan go from 10-0 down to win by 20 against Miami in the round of 64, Michigan State rather, that was the time to sell on Michigan State. I thought that distorted reality a little bit, because if you'd watched Michigan State at all this year, And even recently, with the exception to the Miami game, they didn't look like a team that could play with Kansas. And so I wasn't surprised by that result. In terms of Kansas-Purdue, listen, Kansas is the better team. Kansas has got what will amount to home court advantage. Kansas should win the game. But you're exactly right from a star power perspective. This is one of the games I'm looking most forward to because it is the two – I think two most likely candidates for National Player of the Year. If UCLA is to go win the South Regional and Lonzo's terrific, I think Lonzo Ball will – he's already in the conversation. I think he could be propelled to the top of that conversation because then you just start to look at the big picture and go, like, who really changed a program more than Lonzo Ball this year? But for most of the past couple months, it has been Swanigan and Mason. Obviously, they play different positions. One's a big, one's a point guard. They're not going to find themselves staring into each other's eyes too often. But still, to have 10 players on the court and two of them are two of the guys who have had some of the very best years – not only this season, but in recent years. I mean, Mason's doing some stuff that's never been done before in the Big 12. Swanigan's doing stuff that hasn't been done in decades in the Big 10. They both had remarkable seasons, so that's going to be something that contributes to the way National Player of the Year voting breaks down. I don't think it should necessarily be the determining factor, what happens in this game. Again, I'll go back to what I said earlier about drawing big conclusions off of one game, but certainly it'll have an influence.
Which coach, in your guys' estimation, has a bit of an edge here? Is it Self on the KU sidelines, or do we think Painter can step up and get this team to the Elite Eight?
Listen, I think Bill Self's a Hall of Famer and will be this year. Later on, this I guess I would assume it'll be announced sometime next week. But there is, like, you look at that track record, and if you're trying to find a knock on him, you're trying to ding him a little bit, it starts with him losing games in the NCAA tournament that he's not supposed to lose. I think they've been a one seed, and you guys might know this stat better than I, but like six times at Kansas, Bill has, and he's only made the Final Four once as a one seed. Like, that's not good. And so, you don't have to have your calculator out to figure that one. And so here we are again, and this is the place you catch him, you know, here or in the next game, somewhere usually before the Final Four. So if you're wanting to believe in Purdue, a lot of it's going to be rooted in Matt Painter. A lot of it's going to be rooted in Caleb Swanigan. But some of it can also be rooted in you just don't believe in Bill Self in these spots because – again, the truth is he hasn't been great in these spots.
Payne, two things with this game in regards to this number.
I'm going to say this. That was the nicest the nicest crapping on Bill Self I've ever heard, and I agree with that, all those sentiments.
when we look at this number, Payne, we saw Kansas open as a four-point favorite, number out to five, a little bit of sharp money helping you push there. First thing, do you feel like there's enough of a home court advantage built into it in favor of Kansas? And ultimately, where do we see this number going, knowing that there's going to be very strong public sentiment on the favorite?
I'm not sure if home court has been factored in enough here. It is going to be a madhouse, a virtual home game. Power number-wise, you're looking at probably two factor in home court advantage, maybe three and a half, four. This is kind of how we get here. I have heard six is going to be the buy point on Purdue. So I think that's where this would kind of max out, peak, so to speak, despite the time slot and all the public sentiment for Kansas.
It's going to be a game that I think books will be in a bit of a position here. And we know this time of year, so few decisions that the volume really gets ratcheted up. Be interesting to see exactly if that resistance does come in at six, given some of those intriguing on-court matchups. From Thursday on to Friday, and I guess we'll start in the East and we'll shift gears to the South since that's the real blue blood region. I guess the bracket that nobody thought any of these four teams would be there, except maybe the players, coaches, and alum. Florida, a 2-1 favorite to come out of the East at Madison Square Garden. Wisconsin right behind them at 11-5. You look at Baylor at 5-2. And South Carolina, the so-called long shot, at a shade less than 5-1. I joked off air, guys, that this would be better if these four teams were meeting for a spring football tournament. And that's what we got to see. Have to imagine tickets going to be an easy get in with no Duke and Villanova in the mix. But Gary, when we look at these four teams, who in your opinion has the edge as we talk about trying to get through to Phoenix and be the representative of the East?
I would say Baylor, if only because, you know, I've been watching for 4 months, and Baylor, certainly out of this group of teams, has been the better team for the past 4 months. And I don't mean like in December or in February or at certain point, like consistently since November, Baylor has been a legitimate top 10 team. And none of these other schools have. I know Florida has been really high in the metrics most of this year, but that never really matched up, at least in my eyes, with the actually quality of the team or the resume they were putting together. But that said, I just watched them beat Virginia by 26 points. Wisconsin obviously just knocked off a number one seed. They've got guys who have been through this before. So. And they were a preseason top 10 team based off the pieces that were in place, based off what they accomplished last year. So there really isn't anything that surprising about the idea of Wisconsin maybe getting to the Final Four. I'd be shocked by South Carolina. They haven't been great. I think they took advantage of a Duke team that was flawed and home court advantage, and they shot like 1,000,000% in the second half. They're not going to do that again. I think I saw somebody tweet they scored more points in the second half of that game against Duke than they scored in 9 total games at different points in the season. Like, they just played out of their minds, and they're not going to do that again. So I guess I would assume it's going to be Baylor, Wisconsin, or Florida, not South Carolina. A little bit like in the West, I assume it's going to be Gonzaga, West Virginia, or Arizona, not Xavier. I think South Carolina is a level below these other teams. But forced to pick, I'll go with Baylor just because I do think they have shown themselves to be the better team, the best team out of this group, basically from November till now.
Payne, you had an interesting stat in regards to exactly how prolific that South Carolina offensive output in the second half was, so I should give you the floor for that.
Yeah, I mean, it's not too crazy. I think it's probably going around, but the 65 points South Carolina scored on Duke is the most Coach K has ever allowed in the second half of a college basketball game. And what makes that more impressive is, you know, offensive efficiency-wise, we have South Carolina right around 150. So in terms of this, it's wide open. The odds kind of imply that. Of the 4 remaining teams, we have Florida power rated the highest. If not for the loss of their big man, they probably finish the top 5 in our power rankings. Really love Mike White. Wisconsin does have the experience, that tournament style, good half-court offense. They rarely settle. But you look at some of the defensive metrics, specifically around the perimeter, that scares me a touch. They don't move well laterally. They don't guard the 3 well. And Baylor, from a math perspective, when you look at this based on who they play in the first round, they present the most value from a betting perspective. But Scott Drew, oof. Tough to back that guy, especially when you talk about Frank Martin. And just watch the second half of that game. Yes, they shot lights out, but just watch the last 5 minutes of that game, what he did to Coach K. I mean, literally getting lobs out of timeout, scoring out of every dead ball situation. It was men amongst boys there, and I think it will be similar for Frank Martin versus Scott Drew. I'm just not sure they have the horses to advance, though. So that's going to be an interesting matchup.
I'm not sure I really want to talk about Baylor, the loose ball situation in the waning seconds to take my -4.5 ticket on the Bears from win territory against USC and put it into the L column, almost a microcosm of the way things went over the first 4 days, aside from Princeton +7 that we gave out on this very fine podcast a week ago. One last thing, guys, before we close the book on the East, I will say Florida, the biggest long shot, at least at one point during the season, of the 16 remaining teams. You could have purchased the Gators in the futures market at 150-1. So I think they deserve a ton of credit going from kind of an afterthought, very much in the discussion, and the so-called favorite to come out of the East and represent not only their program and conference, but to kind of show what Mike White has done for this program. Into the South, a regional that's going to take place right in Gary's backyard at the FedEx Forum in Memphis, Tennessee. We'll start with the appetizer, Butler and North Carolina, where North Carolina, a 7-point favorite, total in this game, 143. North Carolina, the only odds-on favorite to come out of a particular region. You do have to lay $1.15 at BetOnline on the Tar Heels. UCLA checks in behind them at 5-2. Kentucky, a shade better at 3-1, and Butler, the long shot at 8-1. And Gary, the first question I have for you at this particular game, what's the real scoop on Joel Berry's injury, and is he operating at maybe a 65-70% clip at best?
Yeah, he's not 100%, that's clear, but I don't think he has to be 100% for them to get by Butler. It's a concern, though, and it seems like we always run into this, or often run into this with North Carolina. You remember 2009, it was Who was a little point guard? Now he's got a drinking problem. to the 2009 point guard in North Carolina.
Ty Lawson.
I don't know why I couldn't think of his name, but I could reference his alcohol problem. Then of course 2012 Kendall Marshall gets hurt. So they've had. And the Ty Lawson thing ended up not being a big deal. They still won the national title. The Kendall Marshall thing was a big deal, might have cost them a national title. And so here we are again with the North Carolina point guard. Needs to be close to good to go to be able to deal with Lonzo or De'Aaron Fox in the Elite Eight. But I think Carolina can get by Butler. Even if I don't think Carolina's got to be at its best to win the first game. It probably has to be at its best to win the second one.
When we look at this North Carolina team, Payne, and their performance, sloppy, probably a positive adjective to describe their performance against Arkansas. But were there things that you saw the Razorbacks expose in North Carolina that any of these teams in this region can use going forward?
Probably not Butler, but as Gary alluded to, as they move forward with a team with a real point guard, North Carolina just doesn't run great half-court stuff. And this is the time of year where it's much easier to slow a game down than it is to speed it up. And we've seen that give Roy Williams issues in the past. Teams that have won the national championship, they've had to have been extremely loaded with 5, 6, 7, 8 NBA guys for Roy to win a national championship. Butler, we're not really sure what they are. They seem to play up to the level of their competition, have some shocking wins and some shocking losses. But I think they do enough. I think that scare will motivate them enough to show up for the Butler game. I'm not sure, though, with Barry potentially not at 100%, they'll have enough to get by the winner of UCLA-Kentucky.
Well, we talk about tempo, and there's no greater indication of what we'll see than probably the crown jewel of the entire round. UCLA taking on Kentucky, 19 combined national championships between these blue-blooded programs, the largest total at 168.5 that we'll see of the entire tournament at BetOnline. Right now, we'll call it a pick, but the number is ping-ponged all over the place, from UCLA a one-point favorite to Kentucky a one-point favorite in some spots. And I guess the first question I have for you, Payne, and then we'll go to Gary. You talk about being able to speed teams up and slow them down. Kentucky looked more engaged at the defensive end against Wichita State than I think we've seen probably for 4 to 6 weeks. Can they carry some of that energy forward and maybe get revenge for a game they lost earlier this season as a double-digit favorite to these aforementioned UCLA Bruins?
Well, I think, from a pace-tempo standpoint, both teams want to get out and run. So that will be interesting. When you talk about Kentucky, they have the ability to slow it down, play a little bit better defensively. We saw that. They were bought in against Wichita State for whatever reason. It was astonishing to watch their half-court defense. They were able to play a little bit half-court offense. Calipari, shockingly, was good. He did get out-coached, but the talent was overwhelming enough to where he coached well enough. Should have fouled at the end, obviously. That was kind of the lone brain fart there, but when you talk about this matchup, UCLA playing in the Pac-12, 91st toughest schedule. They are 4-3 against the top 50, but Kentucky has faced one of the toughest schedules in college basketball, and they're 8-4 against the top 50. They do have a little bit of a home court advantage here. They have the revenge factor. There's not going to be a huge coaching mismatch here. I do think Kentucky probably does enough here because of the physicality, because they are willing to play defense a little bit more than UCLA, although UCLA has improved in that department. I just think there's a lot of angles here that favor Kentucky.
Gary, knowing that region of the country as well as you do, how big a home court advantage will it be for Kentucky at the FedEx Forum?
Massive. I mean, because UCLA fans, they barely travel to Pauley Pavilion, right? So they're not going to travel to Memphis, Tennessee. I mean, there'll be some, of course, but I would imagine it would be better for Kentucky if North Carolina weren't also here, because their fans travel well as well. And so the tickets could be split a little bit in that direction. But 18,000-seat arena, I think when Kentucky, UCLA tips off, and I would imagine any of the basketball fans who are either Butler or Carolina fans, they're going to stick around for that anyway. I mean, it's the marquee game of the Sweet 16. I'd still say, 10,000, 11,000 Kentucky fans. I mean, it's going to be a very real home court advantage, to the extent that any Memphians might be in the building. They'll be rooting against Kentucky, so maybe UCLA can benefit from that. Steve Alford would actually be smart to play to his Memphis crowd, because there are no bigger UCLA fans in the country right now than folks who reside in Memphis, Tennessee. It is very much still an anti-Calipari community. But, yeah, I don't know how much that affects the number. You guys can speak to that better than I. But, yes, Kentucky will have some semblance of a home court advantage, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at the number right now, to be completely honest, and seeing the public backing UCLA, I don't think there's any semblance of a home court advantage built in. When these two teams met, albeit at Rupp, I mean, you were looking at Kentucky, a double-digit favorite, now in some spots listed as an underdog. So how quickly things have shifted. And Gary, when we talk about these two programs, I'm sure you've watched them both quite extensively. How do you think this game can be won or, in other cases, potentially be lost by one of these two?
Well, for UCLA, I mean, it can be one. I think that's pretty easy, right? Just if they're awesome offensively, which they tend to be. You know, they're second in offensive efficiency. I got the best effective field goal percentage in the country. They're one of the top three teams in three-point field goal percentage, two-point field goal percentage. You know, no team in the history of college basketball has ever finished first in both three-point and two-point field goal percentage. Obviously, UCLA isn't going to become the first this year, but the idea that they're top three in both speaks to how unbelievable they are on that end of the court. So if they just get to clicking, and this is sort of – I pick UCLA to win the national championship back in February, then again on Selection Sunday, then again this morning when I was asked to update a bracket. And it's just based on nothing more than this. When they are clicking, when they are really going on the offensive end, nobody can keep up with them. They can run you out of the building. They don't have to – and they can run anybody out of the building, anybody. Kentucky, Carolina, Kansas, doesn't matter. When they're going, you can't keep up with them. What you just got to hope is that they stop going for a little while, because then they're probably not going to stop you from scoring too often. Like Payne said, they have gotten better on the defensive end of the court, but they're still not great. But if UCLA is going to try to win the game, it'll have to be done at the offensive end. And the good news is they can do it. I mean, they can run away from you in the span of two media timeouts. And that's the scary thing if you're on Kentucky's side. If you're Kentucky, what you have to be encouraged by is that, listen, you've got one of the most talented backcourts in America, if not the most talented backcourt in America. You're comfortable playing at UCLA's tempo, so that's not going to be awkward for you. And then you can guard them. Yeah, UCLA's great, and I do tend to believe great offense beats great defense, but you'll get stops in ways that they're not going to get stops. I really do think this comes down to the final minutes. I'll back UCLA, if only because I've been doing it since February, but I do think this is one of those regionals where this game could go any way, and then whatever combination we get in the Elite Eight is also basically a coin flip of a game.
I can only hope, having seen North Carolina play Kentucky live and in person, that whatever we get for the regional final lives up to that advanced billing, whether it is North Carolina, UCLA, Kentucky, or the long shot Butler getting in the fold. Payne, we'll get your picks later in the show, but Gary, before we let you go, sounds like UCLA, in your opinion, comes out of the South. Gonzaga comes out of the West. Don't want to put words in your mouth, so correct me if I'm wrong. Who else comes out, and what four teams are we talking about vying for a national championship next week?
Well, it's funny. I have UCLA not only coming out of the South but winning the national championship, and yet I feel less confident in that coming out of the South than I do any other regional, because it's just like, I mean, there's monsters down there. I mean, if there's six teams I think can win the national championship left, three of them are in the South regional, but I'll go with UCLA. I do have Gonzaga out of the West, but I think Gonzaga, Arizona, I think Gonzaga, West Virginia is a coin flip. Gonzaga, Arizona, also a coin flip, but I'll take the Zags. In the East, I'll go with Baylor, if only because that's the one team left. They haven't really struggled at all this year. They've lost some games here or there, but they've never had bad stretches. Wisconsin's had bad stretches. South Carolina's had bad stretches. Florida's had bad stretches. I understand the Scott Drew thing, that is certainly a popular sentiment, but man, this is opened up for him to finally get to a Final Four. And then in the Midwest, I'll take Kansas. I recognize what Michigan is, and it won't surprise me if Michigan shoots its way to the Final Four. But Kansas in Kansas City, like, it just seems too easy. And perhaps that'll be when it becomes, like, way too difficult. But Kansas in Kansas City to go to the Final Four, I'll take that.
Well, if there's one fan base in all of college athletics that needs something to get excited about, there would be no greater poster child than the Baylor Bears at this current place in time. Gary, can't thank you enough for jumping on with us. Outstanding analysis. And for folks looking to keep tabs on everything Gary's doing from now until we crown a national champion, encourage you to follow him on Twitter at Gary Parrish CBS. Again, you can listen to his radio show daily, 92.9 FM in Memphis, 4 to 6 Central, and see all of his great contributions to CBS's ongoing tournament coverage. Gary, enjoy the remainder of the tournament, and hopefully for the sake of your bracket, we'll be crowning a UCLA national champion in a few short weeks.
We will see. Thanks for having me, guys. That was fun.
Great in-depth analysis there from Gary Parrish and Payne. I want to revisit some of what Gary had to say, but before we do, let's get the other side of the coin from the basketball X's and O's. Time for the book perspective. We welcome in Dave Mason as we do every week on Bet the Board. You can follow Dave on Twitter at Dave Mason BOL. And Dave, is it safe to say that you might be the most depressed college basketball fan in the entire world right now?
No, not at all, man. We had a great weekend. You know, anybody that listened to your football podcast the last couple months heard me bitch and moan enough because we got, you know, beat up week after week, especially that Super Bowl. But we had a great weekend, and I know you're referring to the Villanova loss, but hey, man, it happens. You know, I have still the national championship from last year to look back on. The game was a disappointment. I thought Wisconsin was a bad matchup. You know, they lost. Better team won. So what can you do? We're loaded next year if everybody comes back. So whatever.
The man is so
we
great.
We won a ton on that game too. So
the man is so gracious in defeat, Payne. I can't believe that Dave is taking it with the gravitas of an accomplished Philly fan who normally has the weight of the world on his shoulders. But apparently, you win a national championship and all is well.
He slipped that jab. He slipped that jab nicely. He did it kindly. Mason, I know you said you guys did very well. Just kind of combing the internet, there's been this sentiment that, you know, the overs are 34-17-1, that those are killing the books. But kind of break that down a little bit in terms of the actual volume you're doing on a total as compared to a big side, a big decision side.
Right. No, we got killed on game totals. There's no way around it. If all we were taking was game totals, then yeah, we'd be bankrupt. But we're not. I mean, the players held 10% on game totals thanks to all the overs. They killed us on those. But like you were saying, there's a lot more to bet on, and we did real well on the sides and the money lines. So yeah, I mean, we had a great weekend. The players had won the totals, but we did well on the other. As far as percentages, yeah, I mean, you're talking between a side and a total. I'd say on average, you know, probably 8-1 money ratio from the sides versus the total. Add in all the teasers, and yeah, might be even a bit 10-1 side versus total. So yeah, we got beat up on the totals, absolutely, but we made that money back and then some with all the other stuff.
I can only begin to imagine when you get a team like Duke to go down, you talk about money line liability, blows up every parlay known to man. When we look towards this weekend, Dave, 8 games on the schedule, of course, you know, 4 games on Thursday night, 4 games on Friday night. We're not exactly sure where the professional money is going to come in, but what are you seeing in the way of betting trends in terms of sharp stuff and where that public liability is really starting to show and rear its ugly head as we record here on Wednesday?
Right. Yeah. The sharper stuff is yet to come in. That will come in later today and tomorrow and Friday, but there have been some moves, a little bit of sharp stuff. Kansas -4, that's -5.5 now. Michigan had a pick, that's -1. Florida -1.5, that's now -1, -2. South Carolina Baylor under 136.5, that's now 135. As far as public stuff goes, it looks like that Kansas game is going to be our biggest sweat. That's going to be a big one. 76% of the bets are on Kansas over Purdue. Michigan, fans are on Michigan. About 60% of the bets are on Michigan. And Xavier, surprisingly, 65% of the money is on Xavier over Arizona. Everything else is in the 50 range, but those are our biggest exposures as of now. But again, probably 95% of the action is yet to come in. So, you know, take those trends with a grain of salt.
And Dave, when we talk about some of the options for folks, and I don't think they'll have to reload it if they were just betting totals with you guys, what kind of promotions can our Bet the Board listeners expect at BOL this weekend?
Well, if you do not have a BetOnline account yet, head over to betonline.ag, sign up, and use promo code 75BTB for first-timer welcome bonus of 75%. If you already have a BetOnline account, and you have not used this reload bonus yet, use promo code 35BTB for a one-time 35% sportsbook bonus. The maximum bonus on either of those offers is $1,000. So, you know, you can load up your account and get a lot of free plays in there to last you all weekend long. The terms and conditions can be found at promotions.betonline.ag/bettheboard.
Dave, always great getting your perspective. We'll send you some WD-40 for that fan we hear in the background to try and quiet that thing down a little bit. And realize there's plenty.
Hey man, I just cleaned it up.
There's plenty of good basketball left, even without your Villanova Wildcats in the mix.
Yeah, man. They're ranked. Pomeroy has them ranked number one in preseason next year.
here we go, Payne. We're going to have to drink this Villanova Kool-Aid up until the season starts.
Edit out that free plug. Jesus.
Sorry. That's Dave Mason at BOL. You can follow him on Twitter at Dave Mason BOL. Dave, enjoy the games this weekend, and good luck to you in the house, my friend.
Boys, later.
Payne, I think a lot of people hearing Dave talk about the disparity between totals and sides might be slightly surprised by that number. Eight times the action on sides that the house compared to what they'll see on totals.
That was actually the first thing I thought of, because I saw the internet like just going nuts. Like, oh, books must be getting absolutely killed. All these games are going over. And it's just, you know, it's all about the big decision, the bailout game. Sides obviously definitely garner more action, but you know, even from a side-to-side perspective, there's certain games, as you know, you've been behind the counter, that just mean more than others. They did very well. It would have been an absolute landslide for the books had St. Mary's in Cincinnati covered in those back-to-back, you know, bailout games on Saturday and Sunday.
Well, you look at what some of the notes came out, and you know, some prominent books here saying that six-figure losses on that St. Mary's Arizona game. I don't think it was quite as pronounced on UCLA Cincinnati, knowing the dominoes that fell before you got to that game with some of that Duke moneyline parlay liability getting blown out of the water. But you're exactly right. Everyone goes, well, but don't books have to win, you know, 55-60% of the decisions? There are days in the sports book, whether it's NFL or the NCAA tournament, you can win one game, and that can make your entire day if that game falls at the right time. It blows up all the parlays, and there's 70 to 75% of the tickets on one side, because much like you talk about all the time in the NFL playoffs, the public does have their say, especially at recreational books this time of year during the NCAA tournament.
Yeah, no doubt about it. The actual game that was funny to me is both those St. Mary's games, Cincinnati game, you know, Saturday, Sunday. The cat and mouse that was going on between the public and professionals, you saw every time that Cincinnati-UCLA game got up to like four and a half, it was hit. And then it would gradually get back up there after two or three more hours of public action, and then it would get hit again. So it's always funny to watch the market and the cat and mouse game that goes on, not just with professionals and sports books, but professional and recreational bettors as well.
Now, I know hindsight's always 20/20. I wanted to kind of get your thought, because I was on the wrong side, and I'll openly admit I had a ticket on Cincinnati plus five. I also had a ticket on St. Mary's, grabbed a good number here in town at plus six minus $1.20. What's kind of your thought process when you have the quote-unquote inferior team? Do you typically like to split your wager and maybe go part first half, part full game if the numbers present themselves, or if you think it's all dictated by the number more so than matchups on the court?
I think that's a good question, and it'll kind of lend itself as to why we went Princeton full game. When you talk about the first half of a game, it's usually dictated by the exact style and tempo you want to employ. Sometimes in the second half, the score will change that idea of how you want to play the game. But I'll say this, why we went full on Princeton was, you know, first time in the tournament in a long time. We had a Notre Dame team that was a veteran team. They were savvy. They've been there before. Sometimes you need to airball that initial layup, get a hard foul, miss a three, and then you kind of get acclimated into the game. So that's why we went full game on the Princeton stuff. But in regards to the St. Mary's game, for me, it would have been first half or nothing, especially once you got that full three in the first half, that full possession, because you think they come out strong, and we know this year, Arizona has been a slow-starting team, and those are the kind of trends you'll look for throughout the course of the season. Say, hey, this Arizona team starts a little bit slow, gets better later in the game, so that's when you take advantage of potentially the first half, The other angle that when you split that bet is saying, hey, I just absolutely love this position. I'm going to try to get down as much money as possible. I'm taking first half full game. So there's different scenarios as to when you're going to implement those strategies.
And I think it was interesting when we talked to Gary a little bit about this Arizona team maybe peaking at the right time, a team he picked to come out of the West region, a game that's gotten a lot of fanfare, Gonzaga, West Virginia. We've really seen a battle in the market there. And as we look towards a potential matchup with those two teams, let's say it is Gonzaga, Arizona. Do we make the Zags a short favorite, or do we think public perception pain could play a big role and maybe open that game as short as pick?
That's interesting. I think you probably open pick. Let the market figure out where you want to go from there. I don't think you want to give a key number of 2 or 3 in that area. I just don't think you can do it. Based on the power numbers, based on potential matchups, that's one where we saw St. Mary's really exploit the interior defense of Arizona. That's kind of where Gonzaga's really strong this year, defending that 2, defending the paint. So that'll be a decided advantage there for Gonzaga. And then you look at all the power ratings and things of that nature. Gonzaga's atop those charts, and a lot of the power rings not very high on Arizona. So I think pick probably makes sense, maybe even Gonzaga a favorite.
And I think as we look at the Midwest, it'll be interesting to see. We heard Dave Mason talk about how that'll be the biggest sweat for the house with Kansas playing the de facto home game. Gary gave his thoughts saying that, yeah, you're going to have Jayhawk faithful filling the Sprint Center, familiar surroundings. We talk about some of the coaching scenarios. I will say when you look at that Michigan-Oregon game, whoever comes out of that particular set has a massive, and maybe I'm overstating, but I really believe it'll be a massive coaching edge for that team matched up with a winner against Kansas-Purdue.
I would agree. I think those are two very good coaches when you talk about Coach B. Dana Altman does not get enough credit. There's been rumors that he's been, you know, in the mix for other jobs that he's flirted on, you know, throughout the course of time. I think it's just a matter of time before he gets out of there. I really do. But, you know, the Phil Knight money is good. The Phil Knight money is good.
Yeah, there's some deep pockets up there in the Pacific Northwest, and unlike a football team who went through a bit of a rebuilding process, it'll be interesting. Not that difficult to try and bring in 2 to 4 big players every year and keep the pipeline going and compete with the likes of UCLA and Arizona. When we look at the South, UNC, Butler, I think Payne, we're both in agreement that UNC advances. Feels like that number's right. And we'll get to the UCLA-Kentucky game. I want to hit on that one in a little more depth before we wrap up the show. Shifting towards the East, Florida, Wisconsin, Baylor, SC. Any strong feeling one way or another on side or totals as we look at these two potential matchups?
You know, we kind of went into it in depth with Gary. For me, I would lean Florida in this situation. I know what Wisconsin is. There was some turmoil going on internally with them. I think that's obviously after you beat Villanova, the locker room's, you know, flying high. But I think Florida's guards might be good enough. I mean, that game is going to have to be completely slowed down. And Wisconsin can obviously do that. And they take good shots in the half court. And I think their half court offense probably enough. But I think Florida might be able to get in the lane on those guards. We know they have a tough time guarding laterally, and if Florida can hit the shots, there's going to be opportunities for threes against Wisconsin. I do think maybe just enough, but not a game that I bet. I think we have something stronger later on.
And that game has leaked out to Florida, a 2-point favorite at Bet Online. The Baylor South Carolina game, I know we had talked about the total in great detail. You have seen a little bit of professional money come in on the under. Number got as high as 137 and a half. Just narrowly missing the cut for me. Would it be a first half under? I think two teams, maybe Baylor, you heard Gary talk about it. Baylor was one of those teams early in the year everyone was high on. They kind of became the afterthought, but this is still a team with top 10 talent. I don't think any of us pegged South Carolina to be here, and maybe some jitters and unfamiliar territory playing this game at Madison Square Garden.
Yeah, Madison Square Garden, a little different venue for these guys, so you usually get the jitters playing in the Mecca, and then you probably maybe get a little value here when you talk about the 65 points South Carolina scored in the second half against Duke, the most Duke has ever allowed in a half under Coach K. I believe the number was 2,538 halves of basketball. And we know Frank Martin, defensive-minded coach, the offense a little bit lacking when you talk about South Carolina right in that, you know, top 150 range in efficiency. So that would make sense, potentially getting a little value there, that first half number. What is it, 62.5, 63?
Yeah, 62.5, 63. I'm interested to see where that goes. We know if there should be a little bit of over support, I would anticipate coming in that game, and maybe you are able to grab 63.5 if you wait it out, but don't want to tell folks, hey, sit and wait it out if you like that total, because I'm honestly not quite sure where that number ends up going.
Yeah, like I said, I think we probably have something a touch stronger.
Well, we may as well get to that strongest, and I think it's the crown jewel of the entire round of 16, UCLA taking on Kentucky. We got Gary's thoughts. He thinks UCLA has a great chance to cut down the nets and win the national championship, but we may have a very different mindset in this particular game, where Kentucky and UCLA right now a pick. Total in that game, 164.5. Saw some very real under money come in from a total as high as 168.5. Now has crashed, which I think correlates to the way you're looking to go, my friend.
Yeah, I mean, there has been some money on UCLA. There was a goal for that money, so I'm not really sure how serious it is. I think Kentucky probably the side here when you factor in what they're going to have from a home court advantage perspective. We saw how big that was in the South Carolina game. You got a little revenge. I was just, when I watched Kentucky, they were bought in against Wichita State, and I hadn't seen that in a long time from them. Bought in on the defensive side of the court. Did some things in the half court. So I think Kentucky does enough to get it done here. There's plenty of plus one out there. It is trending at the sharper shops to minus one, but there's plenty of plus one on Kentucky. That's the way I would be looking in this contest.
And when we look at this game, I want to get your thoughts. We've talked about it at great lengths. We know there's a school of thought that won't lay juice under any circumstance. If folks only have the option to lay minus one, if they're only playing at one book, which I'm not quite sure why they wouldn't have an account with BetOnline at this point to at least take pick, would you tell folks to lay $1.15, $1.20 on the money line, should that number get away from on Kentucky, rather than laying a one or potentially 1.5 if the number moves that far?
Yeah, I mean, every single one, there's really no minus one in the market other than one shop, and it's basically even money. So at that point, I'd rather have minus one even money than laying money line minus 20. It's not worth 20 cents in my estimation.
Okay. Just wanted
especially
to
especially with a total this high.
You know, your thoughts there.
It becomes a different ball game if you're looking at a total that's, you know, Virginia, Florida-esque. The math tends to shift a little bit differently when you're looking at a total in the, you know, the high one, you know, 118.5 or 122 in those range. But when you're talking about a game that opened as high as 169.5, that 20 cents not worth it.
It makes a world of sense, and especially for folks that will have a chance that may not get the podcast before this number moves, should it move, and they tune in on Friday. You've heard the thoughts math-wise and what makes a lot of sense. And Payne, before we close up shop here, I know we mentioned we'll be back next week. Still trying to figure out an exact date for our Final Four podcast, and hopefully some special guests there. We'll have a Major League Baseball season preview next week. Again, be sure to follow at BetTheBoardPod Twitter account for all those updates, information. Visit the website, BetTheBoardPodcast.com. Plenty of great stuff there as well. When we're talking about the Final Four, and I know we're not condoning bets on any of these to win the region, who are we talking about, in your opinion, vying for the national championship in Phoenix?
I have no idea. yeah, I don't really look at it like that, but I guess going through this, I would love to see, my ideal Final Four would be South Carolina, obviously, for
yep.
Frank Martin reasons. Gonzaga, love to see Gonzaga, love to see Kentucky. Ideally, I would like to see Oregon. I just like Dana Altman. I like Dylan Brooks. I like that. That would be my ideal Final Four. That would be the perfect. That would be my, if I could hand pick them, that would be my Final Four.
I get a weird feeling that we're in for a surprise, and I'm not sure where it's going to come from, but I think the winner of that Oregon-Michigan game, and I can't quite put my finger on it, whether it's coaching or just teams playing at a high level, I get the feeling the winner of that game ends up representing the Midwest. I can't really get off of this UNC bandwagon that I've been on, although Barry's injury, definitely a concern. The East, flip a coin, I honestly have no clue, and would probably echo your sentiments, which won't exactly sit well with some of my family members with close ties to the University of Arizona. I do think the winner of Gonzaga, West Virginia, gets out of the West. So
I know to me, I don't need the star power. I don't need, you know, UCLA. I don't need the star power. I would love to see Frank Martin get there, obviously. I'd love to see South Carolina win the whole damn thing. But I don't mind, like, defensive games. I don't mind, you know, not having the top-tier teams in there.
Oh, it doesn't faze me in the least, as long as we're seeing basketball played at a high level. Although I will say, from a selfish perspective, I hope Arizona gets bumped, because the tickets down in Phoenix that for the games I intend to go to are going to be significantly more difficult to get if Wildcat Nation floods University of Phoenix Stadium. Whereas if we get the likes of some of these teams not that familiar that don't travel all that well, I have to imagine I'll be able to be a little bit closer to the court than sitting 63 miles above the playing surface.
You're going
to
make the trek out there for the Final Four.
I may make the trek. I told the old man he's never been to a Final Four. He's not getting any younger. That we would try and do everything we can, especially being in his backyard, that we try and take in the games together. Now, I can't guarantee we'll go to both games Saturday and the championship on Monday, but do want to make it a priority to at least take in the semifinals on Saturday if there's any way possible to make that happen.
Going
to
be rubbing elbows with a lot of the coaches out there. That is like the coaching weekend, wherever the Final Four is. Now, not a lot of the big name guys. But a lot of guys looking for jobs. It becomes a full-blown marketing expo for the assistant coaches of the college basketball world, so to speak. They're out there trying to get jobs, trying to make themselves known, create some relationships into new coaching trees. So it's always an interesting weekend.
What does that look like? I mean, are they handing out resumes? Are they going to bars? Are they hanging out at gentlemen's clubs? I mean, where are most of these deals signed? I mean, you have an inside look at what goes on in that business.
I will say a lot of the big meetings usually get scheduled before you get out there. So if you don't have a meeting scheduled, it's tough to get one. But there is some, you know, activities going on at some nightlife spots between coaches. And it'll be interesting to see. There's a lot of guys we know. You know, Syracuse. Hopkins goes to Washington. He wants a guy from a Pac-12 school to be his lead assistant, so it will be interesting to see if he takes that job. Obviously, if you're a Syracuse fan, you know Jason Hart, former point guard. So Hopkins really wants Hart to be his lead assistant. He is kind of mulling things there, you know, potentially leaving USC. So that'll be an interesting thing. But, you know, just to kind of play that role, say Hart leaves, Enfield's phone is going to have at least 500 text messages from assistant coaches throughout the country trying to get on his staff and fill Hart's role.
The dominoes begin to fall. And one last thing, because I know we've run a little bit longer than anticipated. Indiana, if UCLA goes down to Kentucky like we think they will, Steve Alford announces the next head coach of the Hoosiers, or are they looking to go in a different direction?
Not really sure. I wouldn't hire that guy. Wouldn't be my guy. I was making an endorsement last week for Greg Marshall. I mean, it's a no-brainer. Like, you just watch what Greg Marshall does every single game.
We watch Greg Marshall's wife's antics on the sidelines. You may have to get her under control if she's headed to Bloomington.
She'll be okay. I mean, it's a no-brainer here. Like, you go get Greg Marshall. You pay him whatever you want to pay him.
You need the passion and energy for sure. And I know a lot of Indiana folks who live and breathe with that program. There have been media personalities saying that Indiana will never get back to the heights it attained before as Purdue and Butler are on the ascent. I'll disagree. I think the right coach there, even if you have to build the program the way Marshall has taken Wichita State without one and dones and competed on the highest stage, makes you wonder if Wichita State was ever given a favorable seating, what this team could do in March. But I digress. Sweet 16 basketball this weekend. We'll call Kentucky. We'll call it pick at Bet Online, our best bet, hopefully, to get folks to the window and build on some of those Princeton winnings, especially as we look towards the other sports that lay on the horizon. So for Gary Parrish, want to thank him a ton for coming on here to provide all of that great analysis, including exactly the political ramifications of why Duke became an upset victim against South Carolina in Greenville. Dave Mason, always, for providing the book perspective. Pain Insider, who you can follow on Twitter, at Pain Insider. I'm Todd Furman. You can follow me there as well, at Todd Furman, of course. At Bet the Board Pod for all the announcements, updates for not only our Final Four podcast preview, but also the Major League Baseball season start, which looms in just a few days. Best of luck this weekend, and hopefully we'll see you at the window.